about a way that you look at life. Faith is a coming together of beliefs and the values that they create and the expectations that come from what you believe to be true about life, and your faith ultimately shapes your perspective and how you look at life. So one of the very practical ways in which faith works is that it's foundational to our perspective on every dimension of our life, and that ultimately shows itself in our attitude. Did you follow that? So here's my belief, is that faith in God produces a remarkable attitude regardless of what is going on in our life if we understand the nature of faith. That's why all throughout, particularly in the New Testament, we also see it in the Old Testament, particularly in the New Testament, we see numerous examples of how faith is supposed to change or alter a Christian's attitude about what's going on in life. That's why James could write, "Count it all joy when you encounter various trials." Why? Because your faith shapes your perspective. That's why in the book of 1 Thessalonians, the Apostle Paul could write the early church who were losing loved ones to death. And he says, we grieve as people, we grieve differently. We don't grieve like people who have no hope. Why? Because Christians have a different perspective on the loss of a loved one because of our faith. So today, I want to introduce you to somebody. I want to introduce you to a gentleman in the Bible who had a remarkable attitude in the face of some really difficult situations in life. But his perspective, because of his faith, changed how he looked at everything that happened in his life. Now, I love meeting characters in the Bible. And the Bible's full of men and women who are just like you and me. They're just like us. They're just people trying to figure out, how do I do the life thing in relationship to God? And just like us, some days they get it right. And they make good choices, and they trust in God's way and design for life, and they follow that design, and life is a wonderful experience for them. And then just like us, they have days and they have months and they have entire seasons where they don't trust God and they don't do as God instructs, and so they suffer the consequences of their faith. And today I'm going to just look at one of those characters. Now, he happens to be a pretty important character. See, of all the characters that you're going to meet in the Bible, there's a couple of them that are really critical because they're pivotal to the story that God is writing in history. They're pivotal to what I would call the redemptive story. In other words, these characters are critical to what will eventually arrive at the life of Jesus Christ as our Savior. So let me just give you a little context. Most of you, whether you've been to church or not, you've heard of Adam and Eve. Just a head nod, like, yeah, I've heard of those too, okay? The naked people, right? Okay, and so they start the whole story of human history. And then the next major character in the redemptive story of the Old Testament is a guy named Noah. And again, whether you've been to church much or not, you're familiar with a little bit of his story. Then the next major character in the Old Testament, who may in fact be the single greatest character in the Old Testament, is a guy named Abraham. And God's unique dealings with human beings, particularly through the nation of Israel, all take place or begins in the life of Abraham. Now, Abraham has a number of children, but the one child who is so critical to the redemptive story, his name is Isaac. And then Isaac, he has some children, and two of his children are twins, Jacob and Esau. And then the redemptive story gets told through one of the twins, Jacob. And Jacob ends up, he has 13 children. And he has 12 sons and a daughter. And the story of redemptive history is told through his second to the youngest son, whose name is Joseph. Now, Joseph's story covers 20 chapters, Genesis chapter, 30 through 50. His birth is announced in chapter 30, but the story picks up in chapter 37. Now, that's too many chapters for us to read through today. So I'm just going to summarize some highlights from the story of Joseph's life. But it's so fascinating to look at the first chapter, chapter 37, that lists some of the details of Joseph's life, because it gives us some insight. And the author is doing this on purpose. He's giving us a little bit of the story of Joseph's life and upbringing as a way to kind of see how broken his family was and how dysfunctional everybody was toward each other. So I'm going to give you some of the highlights from the first chapter. Joseph, a young man of 17, this is where the story begins. He's a teenager. Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending flocks. This gives us an idea that Joseph and his family were shepherds with his brothers. So there's 11 of them. And they're the brothers of several wives that Jacob had, Bilhah, sons of Zilpah. Those are some cool names. His father's wives. And here's the first thing that we learn about Joseph, other than he was 17 and a shepherd. And he brought their father a bad report about his brothers. So the first thing we learn about Joseph is that he's a tattletale. And then we read this. Now Israel, this is just another name for Jacob, his father. Jacob loved Joseph more than any of his other sons. Okay, that's another bad parenting move, all right? Joseph was his favorite because there was a reason, because he'd been born to him in his old age. Jacob had Joseph at later years of his life. Again, bad all around, because it was through his favorite wife. Long story. And so he made an ornate robe for Joseph, kind of singles him out among the other brothers. And when his brothers saw that their father loved him, it was that obvious, more than any of them, they hated Joseph, and they could not speak a kind word to him. It doesn't say they couldn't speak to him, they just couldn't speak kind words to him. Next thing we learn about, now Joseph had a dream, and I'll just give you a story. In the dream, all of Joseph's brothers bow down and serve him. So Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, probably not a good move, they hated him even more. And his brothers said to him, do you really intend to reign over us? Because culturally, that would be completely unlikely, because it's usually the oldest son who would inherit the power of the family and everybody else would be subservient to him. Do you really intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us? And they hated him all the more. See what the author's doing here? Because of his dream and what he had said. And evidently, Joseph was a slow learner, because we read this. Then he had another dream, and he told that one to his brothers. You getting the drift? So there comes a point in the story where Jacob's dad sends the boys off to find some fields for the sheep to feed in. Joseph doesn't go. So dad sends Joseph to go look for his brothers. So Joseph went after his brothers, and he found them near Dothan. But they saw him in the distance. So there's little brother coming over the hill. And before he reached them, they plotted to kill him. Here he comes, that dreamer, they said to each other. Come now. You can kind of see him huddling around the fire, right? Let's kill him. Let's throw him into one of these empty wells, and we'll tell dad that a ferocious animal devoured him. Then we'll see what comes of his dreams. I love this. This is great family right here. Judah said to his brothers, wait a second. What will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? That's no benefit to anybody. Here, let's do this. Let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. After all, he is our brother, our own flesh and blood. Okay, let's not kill him. Let's sell him as a slave. After all, he's family. And his brothers agreed. And I don't know why them is there. His brother agreed. Okay, let's do this. You following the story? So these slave traders come along and they sell their brother into slavery and they go home and they take his coat, that ornate coat that his dad made for him. They kill an animal and they rub the animal's blood on the coat and they come to their dad and dad, we're so sorry, but a wild animal attacked Joseph when we were in the desert and he's dead. And his dad grieves his loss for the rest of his life. And then chapter 37 ends with this editorial note. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold Joseph in Egypt. And the person who bought Joseph as a slave was a gentleman named Potiphar. And Potiphar was one of Pharaoh's officials, one of the kings of Egypt's official. In fact, he was the captain of the guard. He was Secret Service. So Joseph is sold into slavery. The man who buys him, his name is Potiphar. He happens to be a big deal. And as we're going to see in the story, or as you will see in the story when you go home and read this, because you're going to, it's fascinating. At least three different occasions in the life of Joseph, the author essentially says this, and Joseph distinguished himself as a reliable and dependable and trustworthy and honest servant. And Potiphar ends up making Joseph in charge of his entire household. He handles his money. He handles all the daily tasks and routines of Potiphar's day. But Potiphar wasn't the only one who noticed something about Joseph. The story tells us that Potiphar's wife, we don't know her name, she took a liking to Joseph. In fact, she noticed, and the text tells us that he was strong and handsome. And so she invites Joseph to have an affair with her. And she's persistent. It says, day after day, she keeps tempting Joseph to go to bed with her. And he says, no, I could not do it. How could I do something so wrong in the sight of God? And how could I do something so wrong in the sight of my master, Potiphar? He's put me in charge of his household. I could never do anything like this. And one last attempt by Potiphar's wife to seduce Joseph, and he runs off, and she holds on to his coat, not the same coat, but a new coat. And she goes and shows it to Potiphar and says, he tried to assault me. And Potiphar has Joseph thrown into prison. And he'll spend 3 years in prison for a crime that he never committed. But it's interesting, the author notes that Joseph distinguishes himself as a reliable and trustworthy and honest prisoner. And so the captain of the prison puts Joseph in charge of all the affairs of the prison. Now, I'm making a very long story short. And so there comes this, this opportunity where the Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, needs some help, some guidance. And Joseph is summoned from prison to come and help the Pharaoh. And he proves to be very helpful. And so the Pharaoh has Joseph relieved from prison, put into his service. And what happens? Joseph distinguishes himself. And pretty soon, the Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, makes Joseph the second most powerful man in the entire Egyptian empire. So we read this. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has made all of this known to you, what he had made known was that there was a famine approaching and that the Pharaoh would be wise to get prepared for the famine. There's no one so discerning and wise as you. You shall be in charge of my palace. You shall be in charge of all my people, are to submit to your orders. Only with respect to the throne will I be greater than you. So Pharaoh said to Joseph, I hereby put you in charge of the whole land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh took his signet ring from his finger and he put it on Joseph's finger. That was a bestowal of authority. And he dressed him in robes of fine linen and he put a gold chain around his neck. And suddenly Joseph's life has completely changed. But there's more. He came with a company car. He had him ride in chariots as second in command, and people shouted before him, make way, every time Joseph shouted, make way. Thus, he put him in charge of the whole land of Egypt. And then the author notes this. Joseph was 30 years old when he entered the service of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. Now, math isn't my strong suit, but I used a calculator. That's 13 years since the time he had been sold. That's a lot of life for a young man. And just as Joseph predicted, just as Joseph had counseled the Pharaoh, a famine came. But the Pharaoh was prepared that he could feed his nation and he could make a lot of money providing food for surrounding nations. And when the famine had spread over the whole country, Joseph opened all the storehouses and he sold grain to the Egyptians, for the famine was severe throughout Egypt. And all the world came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph because the famine was severe everywhere. Guess where else it was severe? Back in the land of Israel. And there was an old man and his name was Jacob. And at one time he had 12 sons, but one of them died. And so Jacob instructs his sons to go down to Egypt to buy food for the family. And guess who the brothers meet when they arrive? They meet Joseph. We read this. Now, Joseph was the governor of the land, the person who sold grain to all its people. So when Joseph's brothers arrived, they bowed down to him with their faces to the ground. Just like he had dreamed when he was 17. And although Joseph recognized his brothers, they did not recognize him. It had been 13 years. He'd changed. He'd grown up. He combed his hair differently now because he was Egyptian. He wore different clothes. He spoke a different language. They didn't recognize him, but he remembered them. How do you forget your brothers when they sell you into slavery? So, long story. It's fascinating. I encourage you, read the account of Joseph there toward the end of the book of Genesis. And so there comes a point when Joseph can't contain himself ever any longer. And he says, now Joseph could no longer control himself before all of his attendants, his Egyptian servants. And he cried out, have everyone leave my presence, clear the room. So there was no one with Joseph when he made himself known to his brothers. And he wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard him and Pharaoh's household heard all about it. And here's how the conversation went. Joseph said to his brother, I'm Joseph. Is my father still alive? But his brothers were not able to answer him because they were terrified at his presence. And then that. It has something to do about him asking about, how are you and your children? And he reassured them and he spoke kindly to them. Then Joseph said to his brothers, here, guys, come close to me. And when they had done so, he's like, group hug, come on, let's love this out. He said, I am your brother Joseph, you know, the one you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here. Why? Because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. Do you see it? No, do you see it? That's perspective. That's faith. Joseph had this perspective that, yes, what you did was evil, but God has been at work all these years, that I would be right here, right now, for this moment, to make sure that our family survives. And then Joseph just opens up the resources of Egypt. He sends servants and carts back to Israel. They load up his dad, all of their wives and their children, over 70-some people come back to Egypt to live there, and he puts them up in housing, and he provides them jobs, and he makes sure that they have all that they could ever possibly want. Such a fascinating story. For 2 years now, there's been a famine in the land, and for the next 5 years, there will be no plowing and reaping. But God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So, perspective, it was not you who sent me here. It was God. God's the reason why I'm in Egypt. Did you see it? Did you follow the story? So, brothers, dad, they all come to Egypt. They live there. Joseph's now at about 56 years old, and his dad, Jacob, passes away. And what we see is that the brothers haven't changed much. So we read this: when Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "Oh no, what if Joseph holds a grudge against us and he pays us back for all the wrongs that we did to him?" So they sent word to Joseph saying, "Your father left these instructions before he died." They're lying, because there's no record of these instructions. This is what you are to say to Joseph: "I ask you to forgive your brothers the sins and the wrongs that they committed in treating you so badly. Now please forgive them." You see the theme? "Forgive the sins of the servants of the God of your father." And when their message came to him, Joseph was brokenhearted. They still don't get it after all the kindness and compassion, the forgiveness I've demonstrated. They still don't get it. And so Joseph, his brothers then came and they threw themselves down before him and they said, "What? We are your slaves," just like Joseph predicted they would be because of the dreams that he had when he was 17 years old. But Joseph said to them, "Don't be afraid. Quit worrying. Am I not in the place that God appointed for me? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for what? For good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. So then don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your children." And he reassured them and he spoke kindly to them. Do you see it? That's perspective. A perspective that Joseph understood, that it didn't matter what they did to him. It didn't matter the harm they intended. God was at work in a bigger plan and a bigger picture of things that they could never have anticipated for the saving of many lives. You see, Joseph's faith in God produced an amazing attitude in the face of the very difficult circumstances he had endured throughout his life. Joseph had a faith, something that he trusted to be true about God. And if we just take some of the clues from the story, here's the essence of Joseph's faith. He believed that God was sovereign, that God was in control of the universe and everything that happened, that nothing was going to happen in the entire universe that would ever catch God by surprise. He was always 13 millenniums ahead of them. He believed that God was wise, that God was very intelligent, that God knew answers to questions that they weren't even asking. He believed that God is good, that fundamentally and the character of God is that his intentions are always good toward his people. He's not inclined to do something that's evil or revengeful. God is good. That is the essence of the nature of love, is to seek the good of the other person. And that is who God is. He's good, and that God is purposeful. He never allows anything to happen in our life that he can't make something of it, and that he is making something of it. Do you get that? Okay, you ready? No, seriously, you ready? Here it is, the anthem verse. We know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. For those God foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son. We throw that verse around, but do we understand its enormous significance to our perspective and how we look at life? Look at it. It says, we know. This is faith. These are things that Christians come to trust as true. We know certain things to be true about God. We know that in all things, it doesn't matter what happens in life, all things, God is at work. God is at work in the good things of life. And God is at work in the hard things of life. God is at work in the great things of life, and God is at work in the disappointing and heartbreaking things of life. He's always at work because that's the kind of God he is. God, we know, we trust, we have faith, we have confidence that in all things, God works. He's always working. Even when we think he's not, even when it doesn't feel like he's doing anything, God is always at work in all things. Whenever I read this, all things, God works, I don't know why. I think of an engine in a car. Now, I'm not a mechanic, but I know like that an engine is like the coming together of several systems. And all those systems have to work together in order for the purpose to be accomplished of the car moving forward or backwards or turning or accelerating or braking. All those systems have to work together for good. And God is overseeing this remarkable engine of history, this story that he's writing where everything works together for the good. For good purposes, for things we can't imagine that we would not even intend for ourselves, God's always working for good to those who love him. Excuse me. And the good that God is working for is that we might eventually become more like his Son Jesus, because God knows that when you and I reflect more of Jesus in our life will be better than we could ever imagine. When we start loving like Jesus, and we start being compassionate like Jesus, and when we're gracious like Jesus, and we're forgiving like Jesus, and we have a confidence and a faith that allows us to relax like Jesus, when we live a reflection of Jesus, our lives will be everything that we'd ever want. And God's always at work to bring us to a place where we look more like his Son Jesus. Faith is living our life like we trust God's good purpose for our life. That's what faith is. Every day that the alarm clock goes off and we get out of bed, we start living like we know some things to be true about God. And we live in the confidence rather than the fear of worry. We live in the confidence that God is at work. And God is at work in my marriage, and God is at work in the lives of my kids, and God is at work in my health. He's always up to good. We get out of bed every day, and we live like God is sovereign, that he is in charge and everything's under his control. We live like he's wise and he knows better than we'll ever know. We live like he's good intention toward us. We live like God is always moving with purpose, even when it seems like our life is out of control, or it's certainly not what we would have chosen for ourselves, but we trust that God is at work. That's faith. Faith influences our perspective. And our perspective determines our attitude. Did you follow that? Look at this. Every day, God is doing something in and through your life that has a purpose. Don't read the rest yet. Do you get that? Every day, God is up to something in your life. And look at this. He's up to something that has a purpose for a future you can't even predict. For people you don't even know yet. You haven't even met them. And God's already at work to prepare you for that work that he's going to do through you in places you've never even been. You think your life is centered right here in the little bubble of Bernie and Fair Oaks Ranch, and God's like, oh, I'm so far ahead of you. I got things I want to do for you, through you, from around the world, for reasons you can't even imagine, just like Joseph's brothers could have never have understood, the way they were falling right into the plan that God had for Joseph, and years later for them, and years later for the nation of Israel. And are you ready? And years later, for the arrival of a Messiah named Jesus Christ of Nazareth, who would eventually die on a cross to pay for the sins of the world and offer you and me the gift of forgiveness and grace and salvation so that we could be what? Saved. So that we could be rescued from the penalty of our sin and spend an eternity with God in heaven with our Father, just like Joseph spent with his dad for the remaining years of his life. So there's just one question. There's really just one question. And that is, will you trust God? Will you trust God with this divorce? Will you trust God with the court system in this custody battle? Will you trust God with the drama at work? Will you trust God with the cancer? Will you trust God with the young adult son who's wandered far, far away from how you had raised him? Will you live like you know certain things to be true about God? That he's sovereign. And he's up to things in your son's life that you can't even imagine. And that he's wise. And he's good. And he's powerful and purposeful. The question of the Bible is, will we live like we believe that to be true? That's the question. Because if we don't, then all we're left with is worry and fear and stress. Okay, listen to me. There's some of you in this room right now, and your heart's breaking because of something going on in your life. And there's some of you in this room right now, your heart's been broken because of something that happened in your life in the past. And if you don't fit into one of those two categories, let me tell you that there's going to come a day when your heart gets broken. And some of you are in it up to your eyeballs right now. And God's asking you, will you trust me? Will you trust me, the God of Jacob and the God of Joseph and the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Noah? Will you trust me with your life and what I'm doing in it? And some of you whose heart was broken years ago and you developed a callus, it's a great big scar in your soul and you just have never forgiven and let go and you've never trusted God another day in your life because of the callus on your heart. And God's saying, will you trust me? Will you trust me that I am using the past to create a future that you can't even imagine? And those of you who someday will run into something that's going to take you out at the knees, God's asking you, will you trust me today? And will you trust me then? Will you trust me that I'm sovereign and I'm wise and I'm good and I'm purposeful? And I can take some brothers selling their brother into slavery and do stuff 30 years, 40 years later. Will you trust that I can handle your life? And here's what I promise to you. I promise it. If you will choose to trust a God who is at work in all things for our good, it will change your perspective. It will change your perspective, and that will alter your attitude. And you'll go from negative to positive. And you'll go from pessimistic optimistic, and you'll go from grouchy to grateful, because faith is all about perspective, and perspective determines attitude. And that, I believe, is how faith works. Make sense? If it doesn't, it's at least something to think about. Let me ask you to stand together. Let me pray for you. Our great God in heaven and over all the earth, in the freshness of this moment, we say to you, I want to trust you more. I want to live my life tomorrow like I believe that you're sovereign, that you're wise, that you're good, and that you always move with purpose. God, I give myself to believe in you more and allow it to alter my perspective so that I might be one of those rare people in my neighborhood and in my home and at my work whose attitude is good. Help us to trust you like that. In the name of Christ, I pray.